You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 161 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Artistic Sensitivity as a Spiritual Approach to Knowing Life and the World, 13 lectures, given in Dornach between January 9th and May 2nd, 1915. This is translated by Rory Bradley. Lecture 1, given in Dornach on January 9th, 1915. We already have some concept of how complicated the human being is. People do not always pay this much regard, because out of a certain cognitive complacency, they strive for simplicity, for a simplification of knowledge, for a certain schematism. Only a detailed look at the things that we have been considering for years can show us what a complicated being the totality of human nature truly is. For example, let us take the fact that the first stage of the human being's physical form developed in the far distant past, during the old Saturn period. We will bear that first form of the physical human being within us, but what we still have of it must be recognized as the product of a transformational process that turned us into what we have gradually become. After going through sun, moon, and earth evolution as a physical human form, we can no longer recognize with our normal way of seeing what existed during the old Saturn period. For this physical human body itself was transformed during the sun, moon, and earth periods. During the sun stage, it underwent a transformation and was penetrated by the ether body. During the moon stage, it underwent another transformation and was penetrated by the astral body. And during the earth stage, it underwent yet another transformation and was penetrated by the eye. So, if we just consider the physical human body first, not the ether body as such, not the astral body, and not the eye, but just the physical body, we have to say that the physical body itself has undergone four transformations. Once, it existed only as a physical body, and the higher parts of human nature were not yet a part of it. Then it was transformed by the influence of the ether body, then by the influence of the astral body, and finally by the influence of the eye. All of this now constitutes the physical body, and is the product of the transformations of the physical body. Let us pause for a moment on this. The first stage of the physical body existed during the old Saturn stage. Then, under the influence of the sun stage, we see how the ether body transformed the physical body. In other words, how the sun stage of evolution transformed the original stage of the physical body. Then, under the influence of the moon stage, we see how the astral body transformed it. And, during the earth stage, how the eye transformed it. These are the four transformations of the physical body. Now, we have turned our eyes toward the effects of the ether body, the astral body, and the eye on the physical body. But we have not looked specifically at the higher parts of human nature themselves. That is, we have not considered what sorts of changes the ether body, astral body, and eye underwent over the course of time. During the sun stage, the etheric body entered the picture. It completed its own process of development during the sun stage, and then it underwent changes during the moon stage because of the influx of the astral body, and during the earth stage due to the influx of the eye. These changes ultimately resulted in a threefold etheric body. Finally, during the moon stage, the astral body entered the picture. It developed itself through its own astrality during the moon stage, and developed further during the earth stage through the eye. But now, during the earth stage, the eye itself has come forward as an individual aspect. We can also consider all of this from another point of view. If we turn our attention toward the eye, we find that we actually have within us a fourfold eye. We have the product of the way the eye transformed the physical body. Then we also have the product of the way the eye transformed the etheric body, as well as the astral body. And now we also have the eye that has developed out of itself. But here we shall pose a different question. If we look at the human being and its presence on the physical plane, we know, if we count up all the different sections on this diagram, that the human is a tenfold being. So when the human being stands before us on the physical plane, what parts of this tenfold nature are truly before us? Now, basically, very little of this is really on the physical plane. Most of what I have written down here is hidden. What stands before us is, first of all, this I, see diagram. I'm going to call this I number one. What is this I? This I is the physical body. It is the result of how the I transformed the physical body. Please, pay careful attention to what I am saying here and what I am going to say, because that is the only way that you will grasp it properly. I'll read these off. I number one, externally perceptible. I number four, as inner experience. I number two, as speech and song. I number three, as creative imagination. When you stand before a human being and look at the form of the body, the physiognomy of the nose, the mouth, when you see how the person looks and who the person is, and even if you were to cut open the body as an anatomist or physiologist, everything that you see is the product of how the eye has transformed the physical body. The forms that the moon stage, the sun stage, and the Saturn stage had once given to the physical body evade our gaze and remain hidden. Only what the eye has made out of the physical body presents itself to your physical eye, UIE. Only when you pay attention to this can you have a clear understanding of the matter. I will now attempt to help you with another consideration that will explain the matter further. If you have an animal before you, a dog, for example, or a cat or a wolf, then in that case you have something that was formed by an astral body. When you consider a human being, you have something that was formed by an eye, all the way down to its circulatory system. When you consider an animal, on the other hand, you have something that was formed by an astral body. The configurations of the physical body that were formed by the etheric, astral, and physical bodies remain hidden. What we experience externally is actually the embodiment of the eye. Let us take a good look at it. It is the embodiment of the eye. And if we want to speak very precisely about the human being, we must say that the human being is, in the whole of its being, down to the circulatory system, an embodiment of the eye on earth. So, this means that we perceive the form that the eye has made by transforming the physical body. But what do we not perceive? What we do not perceive is this eye over here. If you call this one eye number one and this one over here eye number four, then we can say that eye number one is externally perceptible, whereas eye number four is what cannot be externally perceived, but perceived only as an inner experience. Now, you could not have it as an inner experience if the eye were really the only thing there. I have already said to you that we sleep not only at night but also during the day. We are not fully aware of the whole of our inner experiences. And since we are asleep also during the day, so, too, the beings of the upper hierarchies live within us during the day. In the I live the angels, the archangels, and the archai. In the part of us that is the most asleep, in the will that makes decisions, lives the power of the archai. The angels and the archangels also live in the will, but the deepest impulses of the will always come from the archai. But the human being, as I have already described to you, knows very little of the will. The power of the archangels lives in human feelings, and in thought, the power of the angels. We can say that the will-giving archai, the feeling-giving archangels, and the thought-giving angels live within us as an unconscious experience of self. And all of that drifts and flows into the eye, and ultimately becomes what we call the inner soul life. But I number one is the only one that is actually known. Just as the forms of the astral, etheric, and physical bodies, made out of the physical form of the human being, lie behind what we see as the embodiment of the eye, so too do the effects of the angels, archangels, and archai lie behind what we experience inwardly. So, really, we can say that the human being knows very little about what actually comprises it. When you encounter another person, what you perceive is the other person's I number one. When you look into yourself, what you perceive is your I number four. So 8 out of the 10 parts of the human being remain hidden. But even though these parts themselves might remain hidden, we can still say that their effects appear in certain individual occurrences in human life. For example, the form that the eye creates out of the etheric body remains hidden. The way that this eye, which I am calling eye number two, integrates into the etheric body remains hidden, although only seemingly so. We will soon see that it comes out a little bit as well. The appearance of eye number one presents itself to us in the physical figure, the physical form of any human being that we encounter. Just as eye number one makes itself known to external perception through a physical figure or form, eye number two, the form that the eye gives to the etheric body, can be perceived only by a clairvoyant, naturally. The etheric body is not a body of form, but rather a body of movement. Even without clairvoyance, you can detect how eye number two generates very particular rhythmic movements in the etheric body, just as eye number two gives a form to the physical body. But these rhythmic movements, these inner movements of the etheric body, come to appear in the physical body by penetrating into it, or, to say it in a better way, they come to appear in the physical world. I would like to note that in Eurythmy, we try to call forth the movements that the etheric body generates within us, insofar as this is currently possible. If you were to present a poem or a piece of music in Eurythmy, and if you would step back, look beyond the physical body, and see only what the etheric body is doing, you would see the I within the etheric body in motion. Because Ahriman's presence in the world caused the human etheric body to become so hardened that we are unable to develop Eurythmy as a natural ability, we must try to wrest this Eurythmy from Ahriman. The human being would move in a Eurythmy-like way if not for the fact that Ahriman has hardened the human etheric body to such an extent that the element of Eurythmy cannot not find its way to expression. This element of Eurythmy must squeeze its way in through one single part of the human physical body, and it is hindered by the other parts of the physical body. The etheric body, which is actually intended to live in eurythmic movement in all forms of music, in singing, and also in speaking, has been hindered by the weight of the physical body, which is to say, by Ahriman, making it unable to really carry out these movements. It can express this natural movement in only one part of the body, namely in the lungs and larynx, where it can press air through them. This is what brings about speech and song. So we can say that I number two, insofar as it intends to organize the etheric body and bring it into eurythmic movement, must content itself with one part of the human being in song and speech, rather than taking hold of the whole human. When a person sings or speaks, a spectrum of the whole person actually always appears in the tone and the vocalization of it. What you hear is the tone, the vocalization. But for the clairvoyant consciousness, what appears is, in fact, a whole human being, the whole human, expressed in a certain form of movement. Ah, a, e, o, u. In those sounds, there is always a whole human being, or actually a spectrum, an etheric ghost of that whole human. Except that the etheric body is moved in a very special way each time, so that when you hear a person say, ah, a, e, o, u, what you actually see are the spectrums of five human beings engaged in different forms of movement, and in such a way that the whole human being is not always fully or equally visible. Sometimes the movement is more in the head, sometimes the hands, sometimes the feet. The other parts, we might say, step back then into the darkness, into the gloom. Now, in connection with this same I number two that I just spoke of, whose effects resound in speech and song, there is a being from the ranks of the angels. This particular angel is one that I have often spoken about in these lectures. But this is something that absolutely cannot rise to the level of consciousness, because nothing of what I have just told you about the activity of the I in the etheric body, when we sing or speak, rises to the level of consciousness. In all of this, a being from the hierarchy of angels impresses itself. It is a servant of the folk song. And in this way, the particular colorations of speech and the language in a particular region emerge from the folk spirit. Since the folk spirit belongs to the hierarchy of the archangels, this is then connected back up with the higher regions. The sense of a collected people, a nation, comes to people along this complicated pathway. But this is how it is at this point. For behind the angels stands the folk spirit, which is a being from the ranks of the archangels. We will now call the next I, which is also hidden, I number 3. We also do not experience I number 3 directly. I number 4 is the one that we experience in a direct and unmediated way. What we see externally is I number 1, and we can externally perceive the effects of I number 2 when people sing or speak. I number 3 lives in deeply unconscious regions. It lives in everything that a person is capable of creating within the bounds of imagination. Everything that a person can call up as imaginative images, as images that are not imitations of the external physical world, this all comes from I number 3, and we can say that it lives on the edge as creative imagination. Here we also need to describe what you can read about in my book titled The Philosophy of Freedom in the chapter Moral Imagination. Here, creative imagination is expressed as an appearance of moral principles. Everything creative, both good and bad, belongs to this part of the human being. I said both good and bad, because you might be of the opinion that there are many people who seem to demonstrate a complete lack of imagination. Then you can only say, quote, oh, if only people had more real imagination, close quote. For even a small exercise of real imagination is a good antidote to certain troubles in life. I just want to draw your attention to one thing. There are people who appear to have absolutely no imagination in the places where we typically know to look for it. If given the opportunity to speak about what they might imagine or fantasize about, they might just express a general dislike of all forms of imaginative fancy. But if you really get down to the bodily level, or rather the soul level, you will find that they actually have a great deal of imagination. They need hear only one thing about a neighbor that they find offensive, and then they are off inventing whole stories and telling the craziest things about that person. All of these sorts of lies are creations of fantasy and the imagination, the byproduct of an imagination gone bad. And if you take this negative extension of imagination into account, then you discover that imaginative fancy is indeed quite widespread in the human world. If you consider all of the fanciful creations that people bring about by saying one thing or another about their fellow human beings, also when they portray someone in a good light, you will find a great deal of imagination, even if those people who lack imagination in the usual more noble sense of the word. Human capacities sometimes go off course, and falsehood and rumor-mongering are nothing more than imagination gone wrong. On the whole, we can say that I number 3 is moving down in the streams of humanity, because everything that a human being can create of itself, parenthesis, everything that bubbles forth from the depths of his soul life, both in good forms and bad, close parenthesis, all of that is what comes from I number 3. But beings from the ranks of the angels and the archangels have an influence on I number 3 in both good ways and bad, coming out of both the luciferic and the aramonic natures. You can get a picture of human nature if you demarcate like this, bracket see the diagram, I number 4, I number 3, I number 2, I number 1, close bracket. With this oval, you have the revelation of the human eye to the external world on one side, and the revelation of the human eye to the inner world on the other. Between the two, you have a stage that I would suggest is half external, the expression of the inner toward the outer. This is I number 2. I number three is the part that is only half internal, coming out of unknown depths into the inner life. Above this dotted line, here are the hidden parts of human nature that lie adjacent to its physical nature. Below this dotted line are the next spiritual hierarchies that stand in connection to the human being. On earth, whenever we speak about the human being, we are basically speaking of little more than the parts that lie within this oval. But above it, we see everything that remains as a residual, a leftover within the human being from the old Saturn, Sun, and Moon phases of evolution. If you were to draw a line here, and there's the picture of the crescent moon, you would receive everything that lies hidden in the human being from the moon phase. If you were to draw another line here, there's a sun image, you would receive everything that lies hidden in the human being from the sun phase. If you were to draw yet another line, Saturn, it would be everything that lies hidden in the human being from the Saturn phase. Draw a line here, Jupiter, and you receive everything that will be revealed during the Jupiter phase, when the human being will live among the angels. Draw a line here, Venus, and you receive what will be revealed during the Venus phase. And finally, at the end here, you receive everything that will be revealed during the Vulcan phase. From a certain perspective, this diagram gives you more or less a concept of the complicated aspects of human nature. It is good to do more than simply consider these things in the order in which they come up during the course of our cycles. We should also bring individual aspects of them into relationship with one another. Today I want to give you an example of how these things can be brought into relationship with one another. A diagram like this can be arrived at in different ways. First, I will tell you how a clairvoyant, for example, arrives at a diagram like this. The clairvoyant would say, "I am encountering a human being. The first thing I perceive about this human being is the physical presentation of his external figure, everything that belongs to his external aspect." But through clairvoyance, I can then deepen this form. In this way, I arrive at the basis of this external figure. But then, if I look away from this external figure, I can perceive an etheric being, and the speech, song, and indeed all the tonal externalizations are a part of this etheric being. This deepens the external form for me. Likewise, I can deepen my inner being. I can first develop my self-awareness in the same way that people normally develop it in their physical life. But then this too can be deepened. You can immerse your inner life in the world that normally expresses itself only through the effects of the fantasy. But then something real comes into being. Then true imagination comes into being, and mere fantasy ceases to be merely fantasy. The human being finds a way into a feeling that tells you that fantasy is no longer merely fantasy, but submerges itself in something real. Then you encounter someone, and you know, there is the inner life, and there is the external life, and the two of them are encountering each other here. There's a picture. This is how a clairvoyant consciousness encounters the form. Then it must somehow unify what it is able to perceive by orienting itself toward the Moon, Sun, and Saturn phases of evolution. In this way, you can inwardly experience through clairvoyance and creativity the necessity of such a diagram. Anyone who has completed the first step of initiation can experience this step in this way. But even if you have not yet completed this step, you can help yourself toward it to a certain extent by gradually working more and more to have an inner experience of the things that come toward you externally. if you put together everything that has been said already in lectures on spiritual science, then you would be able to put together this chart yourself, exactly as it is written here. You just have to make the effort to do more than simply read the lectures, one after another, in sequence, but really try to make connections between the things that have been said. You could come up with this chart based on the material already at hand. And it is very useful to do this, because by working through the material offered in the lecture cycles, you move from an external reception of the material to an inner reworking of it. This inner reworking has genuine value for any true forward progress. Today I gave you an example of how such a diagram could be constructed from the materials offered in the lectures. I hope now that many of you will slowly begin to construct diagrams like this, because first of all, it would cut down on baseless speculations about the content of the lectures, and that is very good. And second, genuine inner evolution would be brought about by that kind of compiling efforts. Individuals who work on these fruitful summaries would progress. You could make more than just a few of this kind of thing from the lectures. Based on the lecture materials that are out there, if you worked productively, you could make not only hundreds but many thousands or even more of these diagrams and summaries. So you see, you have enough to do if you turn toward what is offered by the lectures in the fruitful way that I have discussed here. If you were then to go form a diagram like this to a further extension, you would really be getting somewhere. If you were to exclude everything that actually exists on the physical plane, this fourfold I, then you could say that under the diagonal line lies all of these things here, and above it all of those things there. In this case, we would simply have to reverse the placement. Everything that is written below here would have to be moved above. Then we would have the 6 points above, so up here we would have to make 6 points, and then take the 6 parts written here and write them next to the 6 points. All of this which is up above, we would have to move down below. Again, we would make 6 points, and we could then write the 6 points next to them there, in the spot where the upper points also would be. And there's a circular picture of a circle with the center and these various markings. But we actually do not need to do this, because the cosmos has already done it for us. What exists on the earth is there, and even though the things that live within us, from the Saturn, Sun, and Moon phases, are hidden, and even though the things that will come with the Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan phases are also hidden, the traces of them are still present in the cosmos, in the zodiac. And so we can expand this diagram. Everything that is not a human being on the earth can also be found if we move upward or downward. This is just one indication of how you can connect our elemental teachings with the things discussed in the lectures about the spiritual hierarchies and their connections with worldly bodies. But you will also find many things in connection with, shall we say, pedagogy. Even pedagogy will present itself when we properly consider something like what we have just been discussing. Consider the fact that we have arrived at the idea that speech and song are present in I number 2. We can rightly say that speech and song have been pressed out of the whole of human nature by Ahriman's influence. If that ever is properly understood, something of great importance for actual life will come of it. First of all, it will result in a new foundational principle for the singing pedagogy, namely, that any student of song must be called to become conscious of the part that the etheric body plays in singing, and of the enduring connection between tones and the etheric body. Only when people really start to consider the etheric body's participation in the act of singing will they really begin to experience the transformative impulse in singing pedagogy that must necessarily follow from our principles. Practically speaking, this would mean that the singing teachers would work more and more to develop more awareness in their students of the feeling of what surrounds the physical body, and not just the physical body itself. The singers need not really have a feeling for the movement of their own organs, but for what the air is doing as it moves within and around them. This emancipation of a conscious feeling for tone in the air, from the experience of tone in the vocal organ, is what would result from the proper recognition of spiritual scientific principles in singing pedagogy. In regard to speaking, particularly in regard to recitation, a similar sort of change would occur, leading to an increased understanding that it is really a matter of becoming conscious of the surrounding interweaving of the elements when one is speaking artfully. By way of this transformation, it becomes possible for a tone to become a truly artistic tone, because the speaker has an awareness that when you speak artfully, you are not simply locked inside your skin. I would say it this way: when you speak artistically, you will feel the tone in the air. You will feel the sound in the air as a living being. And through this feeling, you will have a kind of overtone in your speech, a subtle nuance. An enrichment of speech pedagogy will similarly result in the ability to feel sound in living speech. Significant things will result in both teaching and learning when we go into the intimacies of spiritual science. Humanity is still mostly unaware of many of the things that ring out when we touch on the kind of things that we are discussing today. For example, it would be good to develop an awareness of how a new formulation of sound has been attempted in a certain part of my mystery dramas. You can see this most easily in the seventh scene of the first mystery drama. But in the other mystery dramas, there are also parts where this new approach can be detected. Readers aside, the four mystery dramas are recorded and on the website to listen to. End of your readers aside. A certain inner form of sound, along with everything else that is there, is the way in which a new element of poetic creation will express itself, one that is almost nowhere to be found at the moment. But it will take the place that alliteration, end rhyme, and consonants once occupied. A certain inward, or I would say etheric poetic, experience of sound, as opposed to the more external physical experience of sound that we find in end rhyme and alliteration. There is a need, even in our ever more prosaic culture of recitation, to do away with the old forms. It is not easy in our time for someone to use alliteration as Jordan did, and it is not easy for someone reciting a poem now to emphasize the end rhymes as they were once emphasized. Instead, the emphasis is guided by the sense of the piece. But that is prose. It is not poetic speech when you simply emphasize according to its sense. Poetic recitation would be one with excellent emphasis placed on the non-prosaic element of the artistic form. But that will become possible only when the speaker lives into the inner rhythm of the piece, rather than residing in the external configuration of its rhymes and external rhythm. To do this, one has to live into the sound in a way that I recently described in another connection, in the recent lectures where I spoke about how music composition in the future will live into the individual tones. All of these examples show that simply learning the theory of spiritual science is not enough. What matters is having an inner experience of what we learn and filling our whole souls with the impulses of spiritual science, as I have had the opportunity to speak about it in the past. This building, the first Gertianum, is intended to serve as a beginning for precisely that. Readers aside, actually in brackets, the first Gertianum, end of readers aside. Insofar as something that is intended to stimulate such a change can be established externally, this building is meant to do so by affecting the entire soul, and not just the eyes, by the beholding of its forms and colors. But what has been intimated will be fully achieved only when we feel induced to form our whole life in the same way as has been attempted in this building, wherever such a change is possible at present. But then we must also attempt to really bring spiritual science to life, to really let it flow into what we undertake and intend to do. It is necessary to become conscious of the fact that the spiritual scientific worldview provides something that is meant to engender a kind of new human being in place of the old human being that has come down to us like an heirloom from an earlier stage of Earth evolution. At the same time, we develop the preconditions in ourselves through spiritual science that will help give birth to what is to be born in the future on Earth. If you want that, then you must connect very, very deeply with your whole being to spiritual science. Here and there we have already seen beautiful examples of such a deep connection. We have already spoken often of one outstanding example. I would like to take this opportunity to say a few words in closing by our friend Christian Morgenstern, which should serve as an example of how spiritual science can fill one's heart and soul as an inner experience. Spiritual science does not fill us as completely as it could, because we take it up theoretically. It will fill us only when it lives into every fiber of our being. And this is one example, among many, of how spiritual science was expressed so beautifully in a poem like this one by Christian Morgenstern. Superficially, this poem could have been written from the perspective of another worldview, but in reality it breathes, not only in every line, but in the vocalization, a vocalization on the soul level, in this case. It completely breathes the spirit of our spiritual science. Quote, "Like all that is, I am born from God. With all that is mine, I go into God to die. I turn homeward, O God, to live as yours. At first I was given from your eye. Then what was given had to be earned. You had to be raised as you, breast to breast. But right in the middle, pride sought to corrupt it, and it became you, and you were lost to pride, until you powerfully wore me down. Then I was born a second time. Then I understood for the first time how to die. Then I felt for the first time what it was to live." The end of Lecture 1.